Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and Peter Buchvar. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Peter is the chief investment officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory. He has a newsletter product called the Book Report, BOOKREPORT.com. It has great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a discussion. Ira, you recently wrote on the mother of all debt crisis, referring to the European Central Bank. Can you explain what you had in mind when you wrote that?
Well, it was, I wrote that before we heard from the coalition that they would like to have a debt forgiveness of Italian debt of about 250 billion euros, so almost $300 billion for the ECB to forgive Italian debt that they have on their books. Interesting phenomenon, but it does make for discussion. But the fact of the matter is that through the Target 2 program, Germany, and especially the ECB, and especially Germany, let me reverse that, is on the hook for a lot of Italian sovereign debt. And how this is going to be worked out is going to be very interesting. But the fact that the Italians have the third largest sovereign debt market after U.S., Japan, Italy, and they carry an enormous debt load, which of course has been purchased by the ECB through the QE program. And, you know, that we've talked many, many times about this, Richard, and I know with Peter too, that, you know, they've basically have synthetically created a euro bond, which is what the conversation is ultimately going to turn to, and how to fold all this debt that sits on the balance sheet of the ECB, what to do with it, and how to deal with it. But you have to give Five Star and Lega quite a bit of credit, because they understand that they hold a lot of leverage here. That's been my point for a long time, because there's such a massive amount of debt that they know that Italy's not leaving the Eurozone. Italy is not Greece. The impact on a global basis would be enormous. The deflationary impact, I would add, would be enormous for that type of debt forgiveness. So we'll see what happens, but that's what sets the stage for what's to follow.
And Peter, your thoughts, you also wrote that Draghi is repeating every mistake of the Bank of Japan.
Well, I mean, look what's happened. They went so far to the extreme in terms of easing, and now they're potentially going to be entering an economic slowdown with rates still negative. I mean, central bank after central bank is getting trapped around this zero bound. Luckily, the Fed's been able to move away from it. We'll see whether, you know, to what extent that continues. But the ECB, the Bank of England, just last week backing off from raising interest rates. You know, they cut rates to nothing. They encourage huge debt accumulation. I mean, that's what central bank easing is. It just encourages you to borrow. And then, you know, there's so much leverage out there that growth slows, and they find themselves not being able to raise interest rates because of the sensitivity that an overdebt economy has to a rise in interest rates, which is exactly what happened in Japan. And it just amazes me that no lesson there has been learned. Again, the Fed has been, even though I criticize them and going extremely slow in removing accommodation, they at least have done it. I mean, you know, I mentioned the ECB, but look at the Bank of England. The unemployment rate is at the lowest level since 1975. Wages now are approaching 3% year over year. And outside of just taking back the rate cut after Brexit, the Bank of England has not removed any accommodation whatsoever in the ninth year of this expansion. In fact, they added to it with more QE after Brexit. So the inability to even just raise once above and beyond where it was a couple of summers ago, in light of this, just tells you that everyone's becoming, well, not everyone, because the Fed's trying not to, but all the others are becoming Japan. And they're trapping themselves at this zero bound and QE infinity.
And Ira, you mentioned that everything in global financial crisis emanates from too much debt being unable to be serviced. So does this tie in with Peter said, have central banks essentially painted themselves into a corner? Have they reached the end point? Difficulty in raising rates, difficulty in not raising rates. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, Peter is exactly right, because it is. It's always debt, because you're enticed to borrow. You know, let's face it, the last 10 years of global macroeconomics has been, hey, take rates down to zero and some places negative, and you keep, then everybody's able to service the debt that they either had on their books or the new debt that they had. We see it. Peter's written extensively about the rise of corporate debt in America, and it is always one element that's missing from the discussion. People say, well, raising interest rates. Raising interest rates is only significant if you can't, as rates rise, and of course so much of the corporate debt, as Peter has certainly pointed out ad infinitum, is that it's floating. So the debt load increases as the Fed gets them a little more aggressive, or, you know, forces rates higher. And as that floating rates, we've seen it, of course, in a blowout of certain spreads that are significant indicators for the world. But as long as you can service the debt, that's not important. It's when the creditors cannot be paid, then of course you start to send shivers through the financial system, and it's because capital is so mobile now on a global basis, it's a global phenomenon. I was listening to James Bullard I've been on the road today because he was being interviewed. You know, he talks about the domestic element, but I think the international element makes it that much more powerful, because companies are just loaded up with debt, and every increase just leads to either shrinking profits or the inability to, at some point, the inability to service that debt. Because if you can't raise prices, how are you going to generate enough revenue to cover the debt load that you've been certainly enticed to take on the book? So Peter's just, he's so on top of this, and it's dead right. What's the timeline? I don't know. What's the breaking point? I don't know. Nobody else does either. But I know we're closer to it now than we have been in a long time.
Your thoughts, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Things begin to change when the monetary liquidity flow starts to go the other way. And, you know, we talked offline beforehand, and one of the things that I've discussed is that we don't have economic cycles anymore. We have credit cycles. And that was central bank driven, because, of course, when they cut interest rates, you know, the Fed cut interest rates from, you know, 5.25 to 1 in the mid 2000s, and then raised it back to, it was 6.5% to 1, and then goes to 5.25, then back to 0. Each time they ease, they're encouraging to take on debt, and that leads to, you know, a credit cycle. And that means that when that cost of money starts to increase, when monetary tightening starts to intensify, the credit cycle starts to go the other way. And I think that we're beginning to see the early stages of impact, not just on the consumer, whether it's the credit card debt that they accumulate or the monthly payments they have on adjustable rate mortgages or the desire for a new mortgage. At the same time, business debt is very high. A lot of it is floating rate, as Ira mentioned. Business debt as a percent of GDP, if you do not include the Q1 2009 trough and bottom of the recession, has never been this high in an expansion, which means that we're very sensitive to changes in interest rates. So it's not a coincidence to me that we've seen this kind of volatility year to date with this rise in interest rates. I mean, you can say, okay, it's tariffs, it's North Korea, it's China, it's this, it's that. To me, it's the rise in interest rates. It's the tightening in policy. It's the shrinking of the Fed's balance sheet. It's every day that goes by, we get closer to the ECB ending QE. That's the stuff that is beginning to worry markets, I think, predominantly.
Is that what you mean when you refer to the Fed is about to deliver a punch in the face?
Well, that was taken out of context when CNBC said that. So I didn't say that. What I actually said was the Fed's intent is to go very gradual and to be very transparent in what they're doing, which is certainly the case. But I said, well, Greenspan certainly was very transparent in the mid-2000s. When every meeting, he said, we're going to continue to raise rates at a measured pace. Everyone knew exactly what he was going to do, but the end result was still a mess. So the analogy I gave is if I give you a month, if I tell you I'm going to punch you in the face, but I give you a month's notice and give you plenty of time to prepare, when I actually punch you, is it going to feel any different, even though you knew it was coming? Hmm. It's still going to have the same impact. So that's what I really said to CNBC. And, you know, they spun it to sound like the Fed's going to give the market a punch in the face. I guess in a way they are, even though they are telling you they're going to do it.
And do you still see the Fed expecting to hike rates at least two more times this year?
They'll do it two more times and they'll continue to shrink the balance sheet. In a month and a half, we're going to go from a $90 billion per quarter run rate to $120 billion and head it to $150 billion by Q4. I mean, the inflation numbers are not going to let them back away. Inflation pressures are building. The statistics are going higher and are actually not fully reflective of the inflation pressures I see, both in terms of commodities, wages, trucking prices, all filtering into the system. And the Fed's going to be forced to be raising interest rates. So I think they raise in June, they raise in September to get the next two out of the way and leave them open to a possible one in December if they feel the need. Now, this is still a somewhat dovish committee, not nearly as dovish as the Bernanke Yellen. And I say that because I don't think Powell is as dovish as they are. And listening to Rich Clarity yesterday in his testimony, he certainly sounded more hawkish than dovish, and that he didn't really believe in QE2 and QE3. But I think the market's going to sort of force their hand. And even if they don't, the market's been tightening for them. You know, we're up, the 10 years up 70 basis points year to date, and the 2 years up by a similar amount. And the Fed's only raised once. So the market's tightened for the Fed already. The Fed essentially is just going to be playing catch up the rest of the year.
And Ira, your thoughts?
No, there's nothing I disagree with there. In fact, when I was reading Richard Clarita's testimony, I was wondering whether the White House is going to pull back his nomination, because he sounded almost like Kevin Warsh in his independent thought and about what he really felt was needed to go forward, and really not being in that fits the Powell Fed. I don't think he's desirous of the Fed reacting to equity market ups and downs, volatility, and and that's important. So that puts him in a much different situation. And, I will probably get that second, third rate rise from the Fed. And I think Peter's right that the inflation data is, at least, if you're a hawk, you certainly can't give into it. what I found it interesting today was Bostic, Atlanta President Bostic's comment today that his job, that he deemed it his job to prevent the yield curve from inverting, which I thought was an interesting comment, especially because of all the other things we've heard lately. So that makes him pretty dovish. And he hadn't been dovish. So that's an interesting take on it. But they're on this path. Let's see where it takes us. But that, of course, begets the question of what's been going on. Will the Fed react and be cognizant of what's happening in the emerging markets, especially if the dollar were to keep rallying? And I'm not a dollar bull, and I know Peter's not a dollar bull, but the cost of the carry trade unwinding, you know, has sent the dollar higher. How much more can it go? Don't know. But it's certainly, I'm not sure whether, you know, it's really the cost of money yet at this point that's unnerving the emerging markets. I think there's so many other issues. You know, Turkey, I don't have much respect for Erdogan before, and I have certainly less respect for him now because he's not even going to allow the Central Bank of Turkey to operate freely, and that's going to cause all types of other damages. But I don't think we've really gotten to the impact yet of the higher dollar costs. These are just the early rumblings that are more coming out of geopolitical, I think, than the cost of money. And Mexico is a classic case because people, I think, have loaded up on Mexican assets but have turned tail and are nervous because of the fear of Obrador winning the election in Mexico and the Mexican government taking a much farther, quote-unquote, leftist course. And we'll see. I'm really not convinced yet that it's the cost of money, so I need to see more.
What about Argentina with the rise in the U.S. dollar? Is that happening because of that rise in U.S. dollar as maybe the first emerging market to be affected that way?
I would say probably some, but Argentina has also experienced a severe drought, and it's, you know, the Argentinian economy has been very heavily agricultural based at this time, and that has caused some negative repercussions for the economy, which has pushed up borrowing costs. But you know what? As I write and I think about it, you know what? If you let the float, and you're willing to confront it, if you're willing to challenge the speculators through squeezing overnight interest rates, we know that works. The French were certainly successful back in the early 90s when Trichet ran the Bank of France with his famous the Ford Franc, where there were nights when, and I know I paid a dear price for being short the French franc against the Deutschmark, so I know what I speak. When overnight interest rates would go so high that the speculators were chased out, and he eventually won that battle. What I find more interesting with the Argentinian case goes to Malaysia, because we have now the geopolitical situation for the emerging markets has been so difficult, and it's now reached a new level because you now have Mahathir Mohamad, who's back with an absolute majority in Malaysia. Now, mm-hmm. Mohamed becomes interesting because he was the one back during the Asian contagion crisis,
right,
that invoked putting a three-year hold on capital flows to slow him down. And it's interesting because who was his finance minister, but who they're letting out of prison, who he just gave a reprieve to, Anwar Ibrahim. And they put together a policy where they kept money from fleeing. You had to pay a steep penalty.
Yes.
So he kept money locked in the country, and it actually slowed that down. So I'm wondering whether Argentina might go that same way. Free-floating peso, but if you want to come in and avail yourself of the higher rates and possible growth there, you're going to have to commit to a certain time period, whether it's a year, 2 years, 3 years, but they're going to want to lock up that money, and that'll slow the speculative process too. So a lot of things are possible here.
Mm-hmm. And what about Your thoughts, Peter, on a rising U.S. dollar affecting the $9 or $10 trillion U.S. dollar denominated corporate bond market?
Well, it's interesting. It's like this Pavlovian dog response of the dollar goes up to sell emerging markets. I think, you know, getting back to Ira's point, like with Turkey, I think when I see a rising cost of money, when I see monetary tightening, what it does is it pulls the curtain away and it exposes things for what they really are. Whereas when there's QE and there's zero interest rates, it covers up a lot of ills. A lot of stuff gets swept under the carpet. And monetary policy, when it tightens, sort of pulls back that carpet and exposes things. It exposes Erdogan, who seems to be a complete nut job. It exposes Obrador, as Ira mentioned, who is a complete nut job and is as left or more left than Bernie Sanders. It exposes Argentina, which is trying to get their house in order, but is still running 20% type inflation. Well, 20% inflation is certainly awful for your currency. Investors become more discriminating. They become less tolerant of problems when the cost of money goes the other way, when monetary policy goes the other way, and the dollar rising finally in response to what they're doing compared to what other central banks are doing is certainly helping to expose a lot of these vulnerabilities that some of these emerging market countries have.
Mm-hmm. And coming back to the situation in Europe, as you mentioned, Ira, the ECB has taken on the credit risk of the entire European system. Will Germany continue to backstop Europe, in your opinion? What are your current thoughts?
You know, I've always doubted that possibility. Merkel's been out making noises. You know, she's getting a lot of heat from Macron and others. But, you know, and then we've had the talk of the rise, or the rebirth, I should say, of the Hanseatic League, which goes back, you know, a few hundred years, with the northernmost countries forming their own league. But the issue is, there's a lot of debt on the books of the ECB, and it's sovereign debt. And there's a lot of debt on the books of all the individual banks throughout Europe because under, of course, BIS rules, sovereign debt carries a zero risk weighting. So this has been a no-brainer for them. They buy the central banks, the individual central banks of Europe, you know, have printed money, have facilitated the budget imbalances that exist, and these debt issues, they're piled up on banks all the way to the ECB, and the ECB through this ridiculous target program. I mean, Alan Greenspan was out last week discussing it too, and how the target really, makes it difficult for a resolution of this. But Draghi would probably say, well, the difficulty is not the resolution, because the ultimate endgame has been that they take all the debt and pull it in, and they say to the Germans, sorry, but you know what? You've had a good time. Now you got to pay the piper. And it was interesting that what's his name, Fivesar, very openly said, all the things we wish for will not be subject to the veto of Berlin. It's going to get interesting because it's not like, you know, Merkel's in a strong position. She's not. She has a very weak parliamentary support system. You have the alternative for. So this is going to be very sloppy. Yes, if the Germans capitulate, I think the euro will work out their debt situation. A massive capitulation on the part of the Germans. And I just don't see it. I don't see it without a great struggle over the whole issue. And I'm not talking about a European parliamentary issue. This will be played out in Germany. And I think people are going to really realize the angst that exists about who's going to bear the brunt of this cost.
And Peter, your thoughts on that?
Yes, It's right. And just imagine that the extent of Draghi, what he's done. I mean, he implemented negative interest rates in 2014 and what he's done to the balance sheet, all because he wants inflation near 2%. And now he's in a situation where he's going to blow up the region's bond market as he steps back and then exposes all these countries' excessive debt levels and inability to really finance it if interest rates are much higher. I mean, the Italian 10-year yield has gone parabolic in just three trading days. On Friday, the 2-year yield closed at minus 28 basis points, and today is at 8 basis points. It's up 15 basis points today. It was up 16 basis points on Monday. What does this do to the budgets and indebtedness of these countries mm-hmm. in the next couple of years as debt comes due? And there's this very dangerous feedback loop, and I agree with Ira that the Germans are trying to avoid any mutuality and any joint and several exposure and trying to run away with that as much as they can. And they will continue to.
Mm-hmm. And what about if we throw in what's happening in the Middle East in terms of the oil prices, Middle East politics, cooperation between Saudi Arabia and Russia. Ira, you've written a lot about this. Like, how do you see this affecting interest rates, inflation, and international capital flows?
You know, this is so difficult to. I can comprehend it easily. I can't. But the difficulty is, nobody knows the way this plays out. And again, as I say, the linchpin to the whole thing is Vladimir Putin, because he controls events in Syria. And Syria is right now the major flashpoint for this. And yet Putin's been awfully quiet. So I really, you have to sit here and wait to see how Russia plays this. I'm really surprised, because I think Putin seems to always have an end game. So when I sift through the sands of this, the end game to me is he's going to get those sanctions removed. Now he's going to try to get to the high ground in order to do that. So I think that's the way that the plan, because Putin's worried about Russia. How he gets to what he wants will involve the rest of the world, but it's about really, Russia regaining what he considers its lost position on the international stage, and all the talk about China and this. You know, he says, I'm sitting here, nothing, everything has to go through Moscow. Everything. You just saw Netanyahu on the 8th of May, for Victory Day for the Russians over the Nazis. Where was Netanyahu? He was in Moscow. So Putin is a very important actor here, and he will either ensure some type of resolution or keep the flames burning to make sure that the area stays very, very hot as far as geopolitical risk.
And Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't have much insight to what Putin does from here, but there's no question that he's got a lot of levers to pull.
And given all this, Peter, what are your thoughts on the financial markets? Are you still bullish on commodities, agricultural commodities in particular?
Yeah, I remain so. I think it's an interesting place, as well as industrial metals and oil. I mean, I think it's very important for people to understand that what's really driven the commodity rally the last couple of years is less the demand side and more so the supply side. You know, people forget that there's two sides to a commodity story, and it's very easy to say, okay, where's the demand, and I need to sell copper because China has a residential housing bubble. But there's been a sharp decline in mining investment, Mm-hmm. There's certainly been a sharp decline in oil drilling investment. Over the last couple of years, major projects have been canceled. Agriculture, obviously, because it's more of a renewable, so to speak, it's a little different, but we are seeing declines in at least soybean and corn inventories. So I think a good testament to how well commodities are trading here is that the CRB index is basically at fresh multi-year highs today in the face of this dollar rally. So this knee-jerk, okay, dollars rally, sell commodities, vice versa, I think that tells you that there's something structural about this rise in commodities and something structural possibly, or at least more cyclical to this rise in inflation than people are appreciating.
And Ira, your thoughts on that, just also in general, where do you see investors as being able to protect themselves or position for enhancement?
But I think Peter's exactly right, and the tell is, as he says, the dollar has rallied. The commodity prices stay pretty firm. I thought an interesting part of the puzzle was on Sunday or sometime over the weekend when Trump put out that, he was talking to Xi about ZTE, and then, the soybeans, found a way to rally this week. And it was because they opened lower on Sunday night. They turned around, because I don't think this tariff story is going to play out the way people think it's going to play out. I really don't. The Chinese always have the agricultural demand. The industrial metals we'll talk about, but food is food, and Argentina suffering a drought. And I'll tell you what's going on now. To me, to build Peter's story even, I think, more dynamically, is the Brazilian real is at a very weak level. So we know this, that when the real gets this weak, because they get paid in dollars, so they're getting about 15% more in their local currency when they sell their dollars. So that's putting a lot of downward pressure on it, especially the soybean and corn market, because the Brazilians are not going to keep anything in storage, and the Chinese, are trying to teach the U.S. a lesson. So they will be dumping every piece of grain that they have onto the market because it's in their best interest. So, and yet, if the soybeans cannot really break here, and assume they'll become a weather story, I love watching them here, because if they don't break, it'll be reflective of less supply, as Peter points out, coming out of Argentina, and huge demand from the Chinese, regardless of what they talk about the tariff situation. And that's without a weather story in the U.S. this year, because if the Midwest suffers any type of drought or Canada has any type of drought, grain supplies will go from massive surplus to diminish very quickly. So it's really interesting to watch. And I think Peter's point about the commodities are not breaking, even as the dollar strengthens here, is the canary in the coal mine of what's going to come in that realm.
Well, great insight, gentlemen. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Peter?
They can go to my daily newsletter website, bookreport.com, bookreport.com, or they can go to bleakly.com and learn more about our financial advisory services.
Great. And Ira?
As always, you go click on iraharris.com, iraharris.com, and the Notes from Underground, which is my blog, will pop up. And all you do is have to subscribe to it, and it'll take you to places that, again, there's no touting of trades, but it'll get you to think about what possibilities exist out there. If I can say so myself, for the last week, we've talked quite a bit about the Italian. If you have had access to trading the Italian debt market, it's been a pretty pretty right on and timely piece to have in your hands. And you have to go do your own work, but at least it'll get you thinking to where the markets are. And it takes us away, just like Peter does, not in the mainstream media. And I heard it in his voice. He was a little perturbed how CNBC wanted a soundbite, but it was so much more than that. And I guess if I have to say anything, Peter's work is much more than a soundbite. So,
yes.
Hopefully thanks, that's sir. What we all are.
Exactly, yeah.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much, Ira and Peter. Thank you.
Thanks, Rich.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.